Good morning. How's everyone? Checking to see if my voice recorder is actually working. Seems to be. So, welcome to Comp 3000 operating systems. So, first off, my name is Anil Somayaji. How many of you have taken a course from me before? Okay. It's always good to see return business. So most of you then are familiar with my wiki. Those of you who aren't, my computer is this computer, homeostasis.scs.carlton.ca. There's a wiki here. There's a page. I don't know if the link actually works from my homepage or something. And the outline will be up this afternoon, but it's actually here right now on the outline page. But so... anyway, you'll be wanting to come here regularly because this is where you'll find information about the lectures, the tutorials, the assignments, and everything. You'll want to bookmark this page. But for now, let's actually look at the course outline. So yes, you have landed yourself in Comp 3000 operating systems. So this is me, this is my homepage here. I have three teaching assistants this semester. One is Ann Fry, who is sitting right there. Michael Bingham, if you took 24-6 with me, you also met him. And Hala Asal, this is my first time working with her. Is she here? I just want to see. No. But so three TAs. Office hours, we actually decided on them yesterday, but the plan is for office hours to be on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. With Annie's office hours just after lecture on Wednesday and my office hours later on in the afternoon on Wednesday. So lectures, you made it here. You did. Congratulations. Although this room seems a bit tight. I wonder if they will... yeah, we're going to have to do the midterm in another room. I'll have to work on that because I think we're... there are 100 people who are supposed to be in this class, and I think 105 enrolled. So, which is fine for the tutorials, because we have two tutorial sections in a room with 75 computers. But here, we're running up against the limits. So, sorry if it gets hot in here and everything, but anyway. So, website, tutorials are Monday and Friday, 2:30 to 4. First tutorial... did you all get my email? Okay, good. That means CUlearn is working. That's always a good thing. So as I said in the email, first tutorial is today. If you're signed up for the Friday tutorial, it starts today. If you're signed up for the Monday tutorial, it's Monday. This is starting early. In fact, actually, officially, the labs are only supposed to open on Monday, but I talk with them, and the machines in 4155 Hertzberg are in good enough shape for you all. So, and actually, I actually logged into them yesterday, and they seem fine. So, because all we really need is a virtual machine running, and it seems to work. So, this afternoon, you'll get things. So, grading. Well, first, let me read the course, official course here. Operating system implementation course, stressing fundamental issues in design and how they relate to modern computer architectures. Assignments involve the modification extension of a multitasking operating system. High level, vague, allows for changes in course material, but basically this means that you're going to learn about Linux and how to change it. So, grading. First off, 40% of your grade occurs basically on a weekly basis. 20% for weekly assignments, 20% for tutorial participation. Tutorial participation, just if you've been to my class before, show up at the tutorial, do basically what you're asked of, and you get full marks. As the term goes on, the tutorials get harder, and if you aren't keeping up with material, you might start getting partial marks because you're not getting through things. But it's a first approximation of a tutorial, a participation. The weekly assignment. So every Friday, when you're assigned a tutorial, you'll also be assigned an assignment. So yes, your first assignment is coming up this afternoon. These assignments will all be due on the following Wednesday. And they'll be submitting them through CU Learn. Now, I should note that the assignments are more conceptual. They may have some code and things on this. A while ago, I tried doing some more frequent assignments, but normally in the past, I've done larger assignments. So this is the term I'm trying, smaller assignments. But the idea is each assignment will be more conceptual than the tutorials. The tutorials, get your hands dirty, get things running. In the assignments, you're going to go like, what the heck was it that I was actually doing? What does it actually mean? And that will also, so that will require you to integrate information from the tutorials, from the lectures, and from the textbook, which I'll get to in a little bit. But so that's, so there's tutorial so weekly assignments, 25% for the midterm exam, which is on October 22nd, and 35% for the final exam, during the final exam period. Now the midterm, so our classes are 8:30 in the morning, Wednesdays and Fridays. Looking at the schedule, I could have put the midterm exam on the Friday before fall break. This seemed unwise to me, because I know many of you will not be here, and I don't want a deal. So as you'll see in the schedule, I've not scheduled an explicit review session. So if you really want an explicit review lecture, we can do one. My plan is instead of having an explicit review lecture, we will have review tutorials. So the tutorial on Friday and Monday before that final exam will be for review. They won't be for, so the TAs will be available. We'll maybe have some simple exercises and questions for you to work on. That will be the review, and then the midterm is on Wednesday, and then Friday, no lecture. Well, sorry, take that back. There is a review lecture, which I know a lot of you will skip. In our review, a midterm going over, this is what was in the midterm. I won't actually probably be there for that one, but one of the TAs will help run that to say, this is what happened with the, this is what you should have been answering on the midterm. And then, of course, the final exam, during the final exam period, who the heck knows when that's going to be. Just as a note, which some of you might have noticed before, while this is the grading scheme that I officially use, this should be considered the minimal grade scheme, in that I normally consider variance at the end of the term, and I give you the best grade of the variance. I don't know exactly what the variants are, but I typically give some sort of thing where your midterm can count for your final, where your final exam can count for your midterm, that you blew the midterm so the final exam can make up for it, that sort of thing. I might change the weighting of the tutorials and weekly assignments, but I'm just saying that if you try calculating your grade at the end of the semester, you might have a difficult time if you're trying to match exactly what I calculated. And if you want to, I can always show you at the end of the terms spreadsheet, but your grade will be better than strictly following this marking scheme. So communication, how should you find out about things? Well, you have the wiki. That's where you want to, that's canonical information for the course. You should be able to find everything here. Also, there is CU Learn. CU Learn I do not use to post content. What I use it for is more for getting assignments and assigning grades and stuff. I'm not supposed to do things like put all your grades up in front of my office on a piece of paper with your student number beside them. It's considered bad form, so I don't do that. So instead, you go to CU Learn, and also that's where you'll submit your assignments. So, and there's also discussion forums there. I've created, there's a news forum, which is me and the TAs posting for you all to read, but then there's a general discussion forum and a question and answer forum. Feel free to use them. Don't actually post questions from the assignments and try to get answers from them. But if you have, but things relating to the course material, certainly fair game. And me and the TAs will try to monitor that. And if you're interested in like wanting to fix things in the wiki, if you don't have an account already, you can get an account. Let me know, but you shouldn't need to. So collaboration. How do I feel about collaboration in this course? Go for it.
work together. Please. You do much better if you talk to a friend and get help. Now, does that mean, oh, here's an assignment. You do these questions. I do those questions. And then we pull them together for submission. No. Don't do that. Not only is that intellectually dishonest, it's bad for your grade. Collaborate, but don't just divide up the work. I mean, you can find to say, so you divide up the work initially, someone works on parts of it, but then you get together and you discuss it because what you submit should be your own words and your work. And you should be able to say, yes, I understand all this because I believe in recycling. If you come to the midterm or final and you see questions there and they look, all of them look completely like unfamiliar, then you have not been paying attention. Now, just say that. So now, of course, you don't collaborate on the midterm and final. That's 60% of your grade. So if you haven't been learning this stuff, I'm going to find out. So otherwise, work together all you want. But if you collaborate, acknowledge it. I'm actually going to put a spot in the assignments when you submit to say, who did you work with and what resources did you use? Please fill that out and put stuff in there so we know. And if you just say, oh, I didn't work with anyone, then all of a sudden I find someone else's, you know, assignment looked really similar to yours. So tell us about it. We want to know where, who you're working with, what information you're getting, because that's help us figure out what's going on. So, course notes. I will be posting at least audio from my lectures. I probably won't be posting much video this term because for operating systems, I normally lecture with the board. So, don't expect much in terms of video, but do expect audio. So if you miss a class, you can do that, but I think the experience is a bit better if you're sitting here because then you can actually interact with me as opposed to sitting there. But it's good backup. The textbook. So does the bookstore have a copies of this? I don't know if they have. I think we put it in order, and I think they refused to order it because actually it's available for free online. So if you go to – yes? Okay, good to know. So if you go here, the website, here it is, Operating Systems 3 Easy Pieces. All the chapters are here as PDFs. You can download them. If you want to have one nice big PDF for EPUB or something, you can get the – oh, sorry, no, it's one massive PDF. You can buy it for $10, or there's, you know, softcover or hardcover versions you can order online. So if you like paper, you can get paper. But – you don't have to. Now, why did I choose this textbook? Well, certainly the price point is good because I figure most of you will appreciate not having to buy another textbook unless you want to. But that's not the only reason. I actually have taught this course. I've been teaching this course for like 10 years now. Kind of frightening. But I used to use I used to use textbooks very regularly, and I've used most of the major ones, and I didn't like them. For one reason or another, I just found their style or whatever. So I haven't taught using this textbook, but from what I can tell, the style seems more to my liking. So I actually think this textbook is better. But I'm not sure, because you never really know how much you like a textbook until you teach a course with it. So at least if you're getting taught this course, at least you haven't wasted money if you find you're not referring to it. But what you should plan on doing is looking and skimming through the chapters before coming to lecture. Because if you do that, even if you don't understand some of the things, at least if you've seen the terminology, you've seen some of the figures and stuff, it warms up your mind so that when you come in here, you go like, oh, that's what he's talking about. You come in cold, you'll just retain less. So look at the chapters before you come in. So, and you'll see I'll have put links to the PDFs for the chapters I want you to look at before coming to lecture. course software. So what we're using for the class is Lubuntu, which is a low-resource variant of Ubuntu. The night this runs well in a virtual machine. It has a Windows-like interface. It avoids the weirdnesses of the modern Ubuntu interface, which I actually don't mind in regular practice, but that's because I have my own weird usage patterns. And if you want to actually explore the interface, I find the Ubuntu interface is pretty bad. So Lubuntu's, you know, not perfect, but not bad. I have a virtual machine, which I'll show you the link to in a second. You can download it onto your own boxes, run it there. You can run your own version of Linux. That's fine as a native install, inside of a virtual machine, using VirtualBox, using VMware, using Parallels. It really doesn't matter. If you use things that we aren't using in the actual course, you will have to deal with variations. Like, for example, we're going to be installing kernels later on. I'm going to show you the Ubuntu Debian way of doing things. There's an Arch way, there's a Gentoo way, there's a Red Hat way. There's all these other ways of actually installing kernels on Linux distributions. I won't go over those other ones. If you like your distribution, you can figure out the way to do the things we do in Lubuntu in your distribution. I mean, I'm happy to answer questions, but frankly, I don't live and breathe those distributions, so I won't necessarily be able to help you. Maybe this one of the TAs will be able to, but you're going to use your own version. To some degree, you're on your own, but I assume that if you're running your own distribution, you're a little more sophisticated, and some of the stuff, at least early part of this class, should be relatively easy. I will try to keep all of you interested, because I know some of you have been playing with Linux and Unix for a while, and some of you have done your utmost to avoid it, even though you have had to use it somewhat in the curriculum up to this point in order to get this. So I try to cover the different spectrum. If you feel like you're getting lost or you're getting bored, let me know. So you're not going to integrity poly, plagiarism. How do you know it's plagiarism? Yeah, well, no, if you feel embarrassed if someone says, how did you put this together? You go like, well, that's not quite mine. I kind of did this. I kind of followed that. It's like, if I actually know how you put it together, and it goes like, you're probably doing something wrong. And if your detector is not so good, talk to me. But basically, do your own work. Academic accommodation students' disabilities. I know some of you have PMC accommodations. That is perfectly fine. Let me know as soon as you can so I can make appropriate accommodations. The PMC Center likes to know about things earlier rather than later. In terms of just sort of general accommodations, I try to be multimodal where I can. You know, you have textbooks, you have audio, you have the wiki, you have hands-on things, you have more theoretical things. So this course goes at the material in multiple ways. If you feel like you're not getting it for whatever reason, because of some registered disability or just because your brain doesn't work that way, talk to me. Again, religious obligation, pregnancy, medical certificates. My basic opinion on these sort of things is that I assume that you all aren't trying to pull a fast one on me. I just assume that, if life is intervening in some way and you can't deal with your obligations to the class, I will try to be reasonable. But being reasonable might mean that I say, okay, you haven't done the work, I will help you withdraw from the class without, getting an F on your transcript. That doesn't mean I just give you the grade. You get the grade in the class, you've earned it. So if you haven't had time to do the work, you haven't had time to do the work. And that's okay. Life intervenes. There's nothing to be ashamed of. So I will try to accommodate you, but within reason. So questions about the outline? Questions, concerns? Otherwise, I will go back to here. So, lectures and exams. So this shows here. So I've right now got the lectures. What I will do is I will put up the chapters. These are links to the actual, see how well that link works. So there's a link to the textbook chapters, so you can go ahead and look at that before the lecture. Of course, you haven't done that for today, but that's okay. The introduction's really skimming through. But try to read these by next Wednesday. Try to look through these by next Wednesday. Process API, then limited direct execution. You will see a lot of links to chapters here. The chapters are relatively small. So I don't think the reading should be onerous, but keep up. Again, midterm, October 22nd. Final exam during there. Tutorials are here. These will this will show up this afternoon. And the assignments will show up here again. Assignment will show up here starting this afternoon. You'll see there's lots of red links. That means these pages do not exist yet. This is normal. So. And then there's the VM. So if you've been in 24.6, this should all be familiar, but there's a 24.6 3000 VM here, an OVA, so you can import it into your favorite virtualization software. It should work seamlessly with VirtualBox. If you run it on something else, you'll probably get rid of the VirtualBox guest editions, which are installed this way, or you can get rid of them this way. Yes?
Is it the same one as the one we
did? It's an updated version. This one's running 14.04. So you should download this one. Yeah. It's running 14.04, and I installed Vim, for those of you who were asking for that. So I gave it. Yes, Emacs VI mode is not evil, is not good enough, huh? Okay, so I think that's most of the logistics. I don't really have. Of course, I have it linked to other resources. You will learn about, we'll be using man pages and things some in the course, of course, and also you can look stuff up on the internet to find things, and there's all kinds of good stuff out there. But if you start Googling for answers, be prepared to deal with things being wrong or just out of date. By the way, everyone can hear me in the back, right? I'm speaking loud enough, right? Okay, so if I'm not anything, speak up or something. I think there is a microphone for this room. I can start using it. I don't have the key yet, but I mean, would you? If people would like me to start using the microphone, I don't have the key today, but I will start using it next week. So let me know. Anything else? Otherwise, I'm just going to start talking about things. Okay, projector off.
Now, explain to me why the likes and board control are farther away from the board than the light switch would be.
Someone screwed up.
So, operating system. What is an operating system? The entire class is about some computer thing called an operating system. But what is it?
Type of software that communicates with the hardware.
In a sense, any program So I like that. So we're talking a layer between hardware, and you have your applications here, it's Firefox. Whatever. And all these applications running on top of it. Think of it as this thing that's in between. Now, certainly, operating systems are software, they're not hardware. Of course, the distinction between these two is not always so clear. But this diagram is a little bit misleading in the sense that this is really the OS kernel. And bits of the OS may also be here. Now, what I'm really talking about here when I put little boxes here and stuff and say libraries and and stuff. This is much the material, of course, what this all means. But your basic conceptual model of what's happening inside the computer is that the OS code is both separate from your programs and integrated in with your programs. Both. A little intrusive, isn't it? In there with your code and it's outside. And that's because operating systems have a very distinct role, which is to make your life easier. And I say your life, I'm not so much talking about your life as a user, although parts of the operating system are user facing. I'm talking about you as a programmer. Operating systems are designed to make the lives of programmers easier. That's the basic goal of an operating system. So one way of thinking of that is it turns the computer. It takes the computer you have. The computer you want. This is not an easy task. The hardware guys have made a mess of things. Hardware is complete chaos. There's all kinds of quirks. And you would, any day of the week, you would sit there and take the actual hardware on a computer and figure out some way to get code onto it and just run it bare metal. You can do this. And if you start playing with small little embedded systems, that's actually what you do. Most of the time, you don't want to do that because the hardware. First off, the hardware from one machine to another will vary. So real hardware so variable. All kinds of things. It has quirks. When I say quirks, that's a nice way of saying bugs, problems, faults, mess ups. They didn't do things right. They do things differently. And how do I say this? Mm.
other thing is they expect a single master. So what do I mean by that? I mean that most bits of hardware expect to be told what to do by one program. And only one program will actually give it instructions. Now, there is a little bit of variation in this. There's some hardware that kind of knows about different programs and stuff. But for first approximation, most hardware only knows about, you know, knows how to take orders from one program. It expects to get those orders. They have to be consistent. They can't contradict each other. But what do we want to do on a regular computer? You want to run we want portability. We want portability. We want uniformity. We want to be able to run. Not only do we want to be able to run our code on multiple systems, we want it to it all kind of try to behave in the same way. We don't want to have to write little. You can make portable code by putting in lots of conditions that deal with lots of different things. But we want it to be the same as much as possible. We want to run. We want to run many programs concurrently. We don't want to run just one program. I mean, look at modern computers. They have gigabytes of RAM. They have, you know, multiple cores and stuff. And they're not called the I/O button. GPUs, oh my goodness. I mean, they can do so many things. So why do they just have to run one program at a time? So, conflict, gap. The OS is what bridges these two sides. It gives you something that makes it so you can live here, even though the world of hardware is like this. Now, the trick with operating systems is they do things that you can't normally do, in that they have powers that other programs don't have. Operating system is a set of programs. Those operating systems, those things do, they get around these quirks and variability. This is, you know, what is this? To fix this, we want abstraction. Abstraction's old hat. You all have been doing this your whole, for as long as you've been playing, you know, programming computers, you've been doing abstraction in some form. So that shouldn't seem like a new idea. Operating systems take this idea pretty far because that's how you get this nice pattern. But to expect a single master, what this really comes down to is operating systems enable sharing between programs. So if you think about a computer as not running one program, but running a whole bunch of programs all together, you think of them like living entities. And you think that, okay, well, now you have some sort of social structure. There has to be some model of governance. Someone has to be in charge. What style of governance does an operating system implement? Is it a democracy? No. It is an absolute.
absolute dictatorship. Highly authoritarian. Command and control economy in the strictest sense. I mean, it's... The OS is boss. The OS sets the rules. You step out of line, you die. That's what an operating system is. You might go, but that seems kind of mean. Well, there's good news and bad news for that. When I'm talking right now here about authoritarian governments, or dictatorships, I'm talking about single computers. You put a bunch of computers together, you have another form of government. It's called anarchy. So, that's the internet. So, people try to impose various other forms of structure and things, but to a first approximation, the internet is anarchy, and that's why you have 4chan and other things. So, for better or for worse, if you take my distributed operating systems course, we'll talk about how to go beyond anarchy, but that's next term. So before we start going into how operating systems solve these problems, we first have to understand this problem. Does this problem make sense? So if you look at the history of computers, you go back, you'll find that what we called operating systems early on, they all provided some degree of abstraction, some degree of resource management, but they potentially provided much less. Like, for example, how many of you have used MS-DOS? As time goes on, fewer and fewer have touched it. So, MS-DOS, the thing that used to underlie Windows before Windows XP is a kind of operating system. But it doesn't allow you to run multiple programs, at least not very easily. But it lets you run multiple programs if you kill one and then run the next one. Exit one, use the computer, and then you run the next one. That's the way personal computers all used to work when they first came out. You might go like, wait a second. This is really useful. Why didn't they allow you to run multiple programs? Because they were pathetically underpowered. You know, the computer I cut my teeth on ran at 1 megahertz, had 64K of RAM. That 1 megahertz also dealt with 8-bit quantities at a time. On a computer that small, it's very easy to make one program that will use every resource that you have. You don't want another program running, sucking up resources to allow sharing of things with other programs. You don't have the spare capacity. So early commercial computers, and even today, still some embedded systems, although fewer and fewer of them don't have an operating system. But as you get more and more resources in a computer, you realize you want to do more with it. The more you want to do with it, you want to make your life easier for programming, you want to be able to run multiple programs and stuff, that's when you start adding in the other programs. So operating systems are all bloat. They're all strictly unnecessary. They all slow down systems.
But they make life a lot easier, so it's worth paying the cost. Now, if you go into the operating systems research literature, at various points they will go, oh, operating systems are too expensive. We need to do this radical change in order to make them less expensive. They're consuming too many resources. They write their papers, they do things, and mostly forgotten. Operating systems over time take more and more resources, just like all applications. And they take those more additional resources because we want them to do more things. And I don't regard that as a fundamentally bad thing, but it does result in systems of remarkable size.
So it used to be programs of 50,000 lines of code or so were considered kind of large. Anyone have an idea of the size of modern programs? When I say I'm talking about the Linux kernel or Windows, how much code is in those systems? So a modern web browser is order 5 million lines. The Linux kernel is about 15 million lines. Last time I checked. It's gotten bigger. Keeps getting bigger. So, Windows, 50, 100 million lines of code. I think it's what it's saying now, including all the utilities and things. War and Peace is 100,000 words. These are big. Very, very big programs. So big they are not humanly comprehensible programs. No single person understands the main programs you deal with on a daily basis, particularly the operating systems, but also a lot of the major applications you deal with. Abstraction means you don't have to understand how it all works. Older operating systems courses, well, and some people still today, like to have students implement an operating system from scratch, or work with an operating, an educational operating system where they can read through all the code and see all of it. I like that idea, but I don't think it's a great one. And the reason why is because I think one of the most important things that you learn in an operating systems course is actually orthogonal to operating systems per se, and that is how do you deal with systems that are ridiculously complicated. How do you figure out what's going on? How do you get them to do what you want? How do you debug the code that you have added into this giant mess of other code? How have other people chosen to organize it? And how do you figure out what's going on there? I really see this course as the one you deal with the mess that is modern programming and how you get your hand around it. So rather than have you try to examine it, implement, and play with an entire small operating system, I want you to work with and make changes to an operating system that you might use. Well, no, I think you all use the operating system that we're going to work with in class, which is Linux. And I say that even if you're running Windows on your desktop or Windows Phone on your phone or whatever, it's still running behind most of the web services that you access. So if you grew up with Windows, you should know that Windows is now the minority of computers in the world. It's the minority because most computers out there are either embedded systems or their servers or their mobile devices. Android runs Linux. iOS is running, iOS is actually a variant of macOS. macOS is mostly FreeBSD, which is another variation of Unix. I'll talk later on about how Linux, Unix, and all that relate. But basically, they're the same thing at the core level. They may have other libraries and other things on top, but that basic abstractions, the way things work before, basically the same. You have Unix in your pocket. That's what tablets are. And if you look at Windows, Windows has its own way of doing things, but it's still not that different from Unix. So learning how things work in Linux, you go like, oh, Windows does it this way. You go like, why does it do it that way? That's just wrong. And it's true. But anyway, what can you do? Not to say that the Unix family of operating systems is the best operating system we could have made, but it isn't bad. Most of its warts can be and are being fixed, and we're stuck with it. You're not going to see another operating system take over in your lifetime. Sorry. When I was growing up, there are all kinds of fun little operating systems. I mean, there was
every new personal computer had its own little operating system. All the mainframes and mini computers, they all have their operating systems. There's no new operating systems coming out. And it's for a simple reason. Because what's an operating system for except to run code? We have lots and lots and lots of code already. Lots of programs you want to run. So what happens whenever you decide you want to run a new operating system? You write your operating system, and then you make a compatibility layer to run all the old code. And in the process of writing that compatibility layer, you basically have re-implemented another operating system. It's Unix. That actually is kind of what's at the heart of macOS, by the way. They kind of, it's actually at basis this experimental operating system for a while called Mach. And Mach tried to do things a bit differently, but then they plopped on top of it a subsystem that implemented Unix. And so it's really Unix. It's really hard to find those little weird bits. So why am I telling you this? I'm saying, okay, so don't go out there and say, I'm just going to go implement my own operating system. It's like, yes, you can do it, and it won't matter except as an exercise for yourself. It's worth spending the time to learn what's there, because this is the edifice you're probably going to be building on for the rest of your career one way or another. So I think the things in here should be useful.
Some nitty-gritty. Let's talk a little bit about what is this thing that we're abstracting. We talk about real hardware. What are we actually talking about? Von Neumann architecture is what we're typically talking about when we talk about computer systems. Now, von Neumann, pioneer in computer science, he didn't actually create this von Neumann architecture by himself, but he wrote about it. He mainly wrote some of the write-ups of it. There's a book called Turing's Cathedral, quite a nice history of developing a modern computer. It's funny to see the politics that go on. You realize people don't have been the same forever. The von Neumann architecture, we're talking about a CPU, RAM, and an IO. So you have your microprocessors, store data in RAM, store programs in RAM, they execute them, store the results there. Also, it does I/O, disk, keyboard, video screen, things out. Modern systems, actually, you don't just have RAM and I/O devices talk to each other. The CPU can give commands to say disk and say transfer this data directly to RAM. And they just talk to each other. You can transfer without the CPU being involved. So that's what direct memory access gives us. DMA, it means that you're getting faster transfers because of RAM. So with the von Neumann architecture, you notice there's no notion of programs. Not really a separate thing. There's just code on here that runs. And the code that runs on here is actually just here. And this thing is just memory. Operating system is really about putting abstractions in all this to make it more useful. So when we talk about RAM, we're talking about adjustments. When I say an adjustment, I'm saying that it's a numbered sequence of values. Basically, this is like a giant untyped array. Addresses go from 0 to some big number, maybe 2 to the 32 or 2 to the 60, 2 to the 64 minus 1. Modern systems, we're talking about 64-bit address spaces. That's what we're talking about. So a program can exist somewhere in there. If you want to write a program in a native code processor, you have instructions here in binary language that will make references to other locations here, and all your computation is here, and it's executed by this CPU because the instructions here are encoded in some way. I'm talking at a high level here. How mysterious does this feel? This whole notion of machine code things. I don't think you've seen much of this up to this point. So I'll make this concrete in some tutorials. You'll see some. What we'll do is we'll have some C code. Take that C code, we'll turn it into assembler, turn it into machine code, and then you can actually look at things and see. We'll make that concrete. I tried walking through it right now. It's confusing, but throughout this course, I'm going to give you placeholders and say, this thing here I'm giving a label is actually much more complicated, and we'll talk about it more later. Because I can't actually teach this course linearly. I can't tell you everything about this one thing and then tell you everything about this next thing. I tell you a little bit about lots of things, but I tell you more about the pieces, and I tell you more about those pieces and kind of grows from there. So every mysterious, confusing term I mention here, I will talk about more as the semester goes on. But do let me know if something feels particularly confusing, because you should be able to at least understand it at some level of abstraction. But I don't like that feeling. I don't understand what's going on. That's part of the point of this course. You have to get used to this feeling of not knowing what's going on and still making decisions based upon it. Because that's what happens inside of a million-line program. You say, I'm going to use this interface. How does it work? How does the code behind it work? I have no idea. I just know it promises something. I'll keep my fingers crossed and hope it will do its right job, but I don't know how it's doing it, and then I'll program over here. That's kind of what I'm doing. I'm kind of trying to program your brain by giving abstractions and then going into detail. The RAM is an address space. CPU is registers. Registers are just particular bits of storage, but these particular bits of storage are attached with logic that can actually transform that. So do things like, I have a number of register 1 and register 2, I can now add them together, and now register 3 stores the results of 1 and 2. That's what CPUs can do. And there's another bit of instruction register, say, this is the add instruction. What's I/O? This disks, video, keyboard. So what an operating system does is it changes these things into abstractions that you more know about. Things like files. Things like networks, connections, web, or TCP/IP and stuff. They also turn it into
things called processes,
which I will talk about more next time, which is the process is the key abstraction behind an operating system. I'll explain more what a process is, but now the placeholder you think of a process is it's a running program. Modern operating systems run many processes. It means they can have many programs running at the same time. Now, when I say at the same time, sometimes that is actually at the same time because it's a multi-core machine and one program is running on core one, another program is running on core two. But also it means that they're logically running at the same time because if I have 100 processes on my system, which is actually a small number for a modern system, and I only have four cores, most of the processes aren't running at any given time. They're shared. How do I get 100 programs to run at the same time when I only have four things that can run a program at a time? Well, you multiplex them. It's just like you have, say, 10 assignments to do. You have 2 weeks to do them. How are you going to do all those assignments? Are you going to do 20, do those 10 assignments at the same time? No. You're going to divide up your time. You're going to say, I'm going to work a little bit. I'm going to do assignment one. Then I'm going to do the second assignment. Then I'm going to do the third assignment. But maybe you don't actually want to do the first assignment to completion. You actually want to do a little bit of the first assignment and then do a little bit of the second assignment and do a little bit of the third assignment because you want to make progress on everything. Because you might run out of time when you get to the end of 2 weeks and realize that you haven't actually finished all of the assignments and you want to at least be able to turn in something to get partial marks. So you won't, it's better for your grade to have done 10 assignments partially than to do 5 assignments completely and not done anything on the other 5 assignments. So you divide up your time. And do 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, then 5. You have to figure out some way of allocating your time to do these different assignments. But you're only going to do one of those at any given time. That's all the computer does. It runs one program for a while, then it switches to running another program for a while, then it switches to running another program for a while. It just does the switching really fast, so it seems like all the programs are running at the same time. That's the key way you share a CPU. So, I now want to take a little digression to talk about something called Moore's Law. And to understand how operating systems have changed, you've got to understand Moore's Law. First off, what is Moore's Law? You all heard of it? Perfect. Yep. What? Yeah. No. No. Number of transistors on a chip of fixed size. Doubles every 18 months. Now, if you actually look at the curves and you look at what's been happening over the past 5-10 years, does this exactly follow? Kind of. Things are slowing down a bit. I would say Intel is for the most part staying on this curve. Other companies are falling behind somewhat, and that's because it's getting really expensive to stay on it. So what I mean is, so this is an exponential curve. Exponential curves never go on forever. They cannot.
because they grow way too fast. But this particular exponential curve we're talking about has been going on since the late 1950s, I think, is when the first, like, Moore's Law thing. Look at the Wikipedia page of Moore's Law, I'll give you a nice graph and stuff, and seeing it. But for at least the past 50 years, this has been, you know, like 40, 50 years, this has been followed. We're talking a lot of doublings. This is why you can fit a billion transistors in your pocket. Billion transistors is a lot of transistors. I take that back. I don't know if smartphones are quite at the point.
I guess they have a billion transistors. I know they're in the hundreds of millions. I'd have to look for accounts.
But, I mean, big numbers of transistors. I'm no electrical engineer, but you can do a lot with those transistors.
And that's the weird thing about dealing with operating systems, is that when I talk about things like CPU, when I talk about things like RAM, when I think about I.O., what I'm really talking about is systems driven by transistors. And each of these things keeps getting more and more transistors.
I mean, well, I had a perfectly good CPU when I had 20,000, you know, transistors. What am I going to do with 200 million?
I mean, it kind of boggles the mind if you think about, like, how much more complex these things are. So one underlying theme you should keep in the back of your mind is realize the abstractions that we work with in operating systems were all developed in the late 60s and early 70s. That's a long time ago in Moore's Law. I mean, you know, just pure time is not that long. But Moore's Law land, we talk down the exponential, that's way back. Those, the systems that those things were created for, had, they had megabytes of RAM. They were big systems. The initial Unix system was like hundreds of K in storage. And now you're carrying around devices with gigabytes of RAM in your pocket. Those were like, so computers are just bigger in every dimension. So abstractions of operating systems at a fundamental level are trying to deal with how to deal with these things, but when the things underneath become bigger, the abstractions aren't so useful, and you generally start coming with other abstractions on top. But if you have code that used the old abstraction, you can't just throw it away. So you have weird things. Have you looked? How many files are on your computer? Pick a computer that you have. You know how many files are on it? I mean, I'm talking like 100,000 files is no big deal. 100,000 files. That's a lot of files. So a file system is a way of abstracting the hard disks. It's a hierarchical storage for naming things. How useful is that hierarchy at finding things when you're dealing with hundreds of thousands or millions of files? Not that useful. It's too big. So, but can you get rid of it? No, you still need to have files. So you get weird things like iOS. You know, I say what's weird about iOS is that there is no shared file system on iOS. And you might go, why is there no shared file system on iOS? Well, there's actually a file system. It's basically a Unix box underneath. There's like all the standard files there and everything. But they actually divided up the application so they didn't have a shared file system. It wasn't for technical reasons. They could have done it without any problem, but they decided to do it for usability reasons. Because they knew if they started having users put files in a shared file system, they'd lose them.
It would get all chaotic. They won't be able to find things and stuff. And so what they instead did was they provided things like saying, here is your camera roll. What is a camera roll? It's files. Like a nice little abstraction. Or they give you your contacts.
You can actually find it.
Oh, that's a little database, which is stored in multiple files on your file system. So the point I'm trying to make is that because of Moore's Law, a lot of the abstractions I'm going to teach you about in this class are actually kind of quaint and in some sense not useful for thinking about how users should be interacting with systems. But they're not going away. They are there. They are the plumbing. They're the layer that we're living with. And then we just keep putting things on top to try to deal with them. Classic thing of this is something called virtual machines. Now, when we talk about virtualization, that's actually a theme of much of this course. When we talk about taking a process, putting an address space and turning it into processes, and I think we're talking about virtualizing resources. Talk about what that means later in more detail, but virtual machine here, a virtual machine I'm talking about is for VirtualBox. You're going to be running Linux, Ubuntu, as a program on another operating system. You'll be running Windows, you'll be running Mac OS, only if you can be running Linux or FreeBSD or something as your main operating system, and then on top of it, you're going to run in a window, in a program, another operating system. An operating system on top of another operating system. You might think, okay, this is kind of a cute trick for learning in a course. You don't have to actually replace the operating system here. It's quite useful things. But the bizarre thing about the world is actually, you know, it's a much more fundamental technology. It's now used everywhere. Like most of the web server. Websites you visit are probably running in some sort of virtual machine. Now, if you think about this for a little bit, you'll realize this is crazy. You're running, instead of running one operating system, you're potentially running on one computer to run different people's applications. Instead of running one operating system and having each user have their own application, instead you have, say, one operating system per user. Remember how big I said these operating systems are? Millions of lines of code? I'm running an extra, say, 50 million lines of code per user. When you go to Amazon's cloud, you can say, I want a virtual machine to run something. That's what they're doing. They have their own operating system running on their hardware. It's called Hypervisor. And on top of that, you're going to run your own instance of the operating system. And you'll have many of them. And so you get your own operating system. You get your own operating system. There. And the really bizarre thing about this is that Unix was designed as a multi-user operating system. It was designed to allow, you know, 100,000 people, whatever, to share the same computer. All of them run their own programs. But instead of doing that, we now run entire operating systems for one user. This is horribly wasteful. But this is also very useful. And it's useful because this means we can use different operating systems for different users, and everyone can maintain them. Moore's Law allows us to be amazingly sloppy. Sloppy and wasteful as programmers. It says that, you know, my program only runs well on this particular, you know, on this, you know, let's say it's Ubuntu 12.04. My program runs really well at 12.04. It breaks on 14.04. So I'll keep a virtual machine around that just runs fully. And that'll be there. Well, I have this program that only runs on Windows XP.
Windows XP Service Pack 2. So I'm going to run Windows XP Service Pack 2 in another virtual machine, and I'll have my application inside there, and that will run. And oh, I have this mainframe operating system that was developed like that was OS 360 that was developed in like 1972. I have a business application that only runs there, my payroll application, my corporation. I'll run that in a virtual machine, and it'll stay right there. I mentioned the mainframe thing because actually virtualization was developed by IBM precisely to do that, to allow multiple operating systems to run. So each operating system is a dedicated environment for one particular program. And you'd have a maybe set of programs, and you'd have multiple ones. Now we use it all the time in data centers with the cloud, and we use it on our own machines. You go back a few decades and people go like, you are utterly insane, the number of virtual machines and all the code you're running at them. But now we do it as a core because we have the resources to burn. That's what this means. This means we have resources to burn today that we did not have in the past. Yeah, we still do things the way we did in the past because all of our code expects it to be. That's the conflict. How do you take the old abstractions and make them work in new ways? Classic example of this, which is what I'll last thing I'll talk about, solid state disks. Just think about the term. Solid state disk. Is it a disk? Do they make round chips? No, they're chips. They're storage. It's silicon. There's not a disk. There's nothing spinning. Yet it's called a solid state disk. And we understand it that way because the abstraction we use to access it is a disk abstraction. It's the abstraction that was used for accessing hard disks. Spinning metal. Pieces of metal with heads that move across them. Same abstraction, completely different underlying technology. I go, okay, that's fine, but if you think about it further, you realize, everything we have for hard disks, all the file system stuff, had certain assumptions behind them. Things like the time it takes to move the read head or the write head on the disk is much longer than the time it takes to access the next block on a track while it's spinning around. Sequential reads are much faster than random reads. But that's not true for solid state disks. Random reads can be almost as fast as sequential reads. Completely different performance characteristics. Not just that, you have this other weird thing about solid state disks, that writes are actually really expensive. And you can't even write the same location on the disk, on the solid state disk. If you write to it too many times, you'll blow out that sector. And now you can't ever write to it again. It's dead. Hard disk, you can write anywhere on the disk, you write the same part of it time and time again, it just doesn't care. You're not going to notice. Write the same part of a solid state disk, you'll blow it out. You have to spread out your writes. You have to do this thing called wear leveling with solid-state disks, so that you don't ever write the same location many times. But, wait a second, file systems weren't built with that abstraction, with that limitation. They write much more frequently to certain parts of the disk than other parts of the disk. How do you deal with that? It's actually pretty simple. You put an operating system in the solid-state disk that pretends to be a hard disk to the rest of the system, but inside it does something completely different. When you run a solid-state disk, you're actually running a file system on top of a file system. There is a file system that's underneath it that the solid-state disk knows about, that its own operating system is running, and then on top of it, there is the file system that you want to put on. And we layer this because if you put your regular file system on top of it, it's just going to blow it out. It won't work. It'll die very quickly. But instead, so we have an operating system on top of it.
flash drives have operating systems.
It's turtles all the way down. So, whenever I talk about operating systems, when I talk about this thing, let me tell you this nice little story about things, and when you slowly start looking under, people are like, oh my god. So, yes, people are doing things like taking USB sticks and turning them into key loggers, because it turns out it's an operating system, so you can reprogram the operating system to be anything else, including a new keyboard and mouse, or a microphone, or what, I mean, you can just pretend to be whatever else, and stick it in. I'm going to try to teach the abstractions and just realize they're all can be broken, or it's just much more complicated than the stuff I'm trying to tell you. I'll try to give you hints, but even with the hints, it's still much worse. But you got to start somewhere. So that's what we do.
Enjoy the rest of your day.